Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about the Midwestern connection to country music. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Cott. We'll talk with author Mark Guarino about his book, Country and Midwestern, but first, some new music from PJ Harvey.
As childhood died, the old year made the soldier appear, the ashen burn night and day, as I she prayed, "Why, man, am I worthy? Speak your word all to me."
That is a little bit of Prayer at the Gate, the opening track from the new album by PJ Harvey. I inside the old year dying. Greg, it killed me when you just said that. But first, some new music from PJ Harvey. Been a long time. 7 years.
It has.
7 years since a proper album from this incredible talent. Born Polly Jean Harvey in Dorset, England. Was in a band with this guy named John Parrish, who was the front man. That's how she first made her mark as a vocalist, guitarist, and saxophonist, and then formed a trio called PJ Harvey. Two studio albums, Dry and Rid of Me, 92 and 93, that absolutely marked her as one of the most distinctive voices of the alternative era. And then she just became PJ Harvey, the solo artist, continuing to collaborate with John Parrish and many others, Rob Ellis, Eric Drew Feldman, who'd done time with Captain Beefheart, Mick Harvey of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, did some recording with Nick Cave as well. The Hope 6 Demolition Project, about the conflict in Kosovo in 2016, was her last proper album. She had said she feared she was losing touch with her love of music. What was she doing instead, Greg? Writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
A book-length poem called Orlam, O-R-L-A-M, heavily inspires this album, which, once again, features John Parrish and the super producer Flood. Just the three of them. Samples of field recordings, acoustic instruments, primitive electronics. A departure. Mm-hmm. Not to tip my hand, a departure for Polly Jean. Let's dive into a track from this incredible album. This is called I Inside the Old I Dying from PJ Harvey's new album.
Oh, I'm I'm
That is I Inside the Old Eye Dying from the new PJ Harvey record, I Inside the Old Year Dying. I mean, if you can wrap your tongue around that in your mind, you know, you're a better person than I am.
Well, let me also say that she is going to the unique dialogue she grew up with in Dorset, England, which is almost Welsh, kind of, to my ears. You know, you know how the Welsh have those words that, like, don't seem like English, don't even seem like a foreign language. There's a lot of that dialogue on this album.
Well, there, you know, and she's the poems that she's written for this record are a dialect. You almost need a glossary of terms, right, in order to understand it. But I don't think you necessarily have to understand it to appreciate it. When you mentioned departure for PJ Harvey, I would say that's almost like absolutely you expect departures from PJ Harvey. Almost every album she's made has been different from its predecessors. This one shares some characteristics with some of her 2000s work, notably Let England Shake and White Chalk, in that it's more moodier, in the more moody vein. A lot of collage type arrangements here. You know, these poems that she wrote a novel length a book in prose, and now she's translating that work into what you know are songs, but it doesn't translate easily as pop music or register as pop music. And I have to acknowledge that the first few times I listened to this album, I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. But that is what we expect from PJ Harvey. If you're a fan, you know you're gonna want to dig in. And trust me, after some extended listening time to this record, I have grown to love it. It's amazing, an amazing work. You know, it sort of reminds me of an art house horror movie soundtrack. She's been working with movie and TV soundtrack music in the last few years. Yeah, people wondering what she's been up to. Well, she's been up to a lot of stuff, just hasn't been making a lot of records. Here's sort of the product of those years of kind of immersion in that area. And this whole idea of the creepy sound effects combined with the vocal range is much higher than we're used to hearing it. So we got this whole creepy thing where she falls in love with a ghost. It happens to be half Jesus, half Elvis.
Jesus heaven. Yeah, and her interpolating a little bit of Elvis reminds me, I mean, it hasn't been done better since Spiritualized. Ladies and gentlemen, we're floating in space.
And it's so creepy. You mentioned Spiritualized. That's a great reference. The other thing I was thinking of was the Julie Cruz floating into the night Twin Peaks era stuff.
Yeah.
You are entering this very spooky, almost goth world, but it's not Sisters of Mercy goth. It's something totally different.
No, you know what it is? You know the original British film Wicker Man?
Mm-hmm.
That's what this
was
is.
Another
this is
one.
This is the album version of that.
Right. I agree with you. I think it's a, and I think it's a it's a departure. People are going to have a hard time at first with it, I think. But I think this is one of those albums that, like with most of PJ Harvey's work, is definitely worth digging into.
Oh, I loved it from the beginning. But I have more of a tolerance for hypnotic psychedelic darkness than you. And I've loved it on more than two dozen listens since. What I haven't gotten is the concept here. Orlam, the poem, is about a young girl, I think she's 9 or 11, Ira Abel Rawls, growing up in Dorset's Gore Woods with this ghost who is part some sort of phallic pagan character and part Elvis, as we said. I you know, good luck if you can parse that in the lyrics.
I don't think you can. I don't think it's possible.
I don't think it's possible. I think all these critics, because as always, I don't read any reviews until, 10 listens, right? And now I'm at like two dozen. And I'm like, where did all these critics get it? I think they went to the book reviews for Orlam.
Yeah.
Because good luck. I don't get it. You don't need to know that. Polly's always been an enigmatic, shall we say, lyricist. It's all in the power of her musical settings and that voice. Man, I am so glad to have PJ Harvey back.
So that's what we thought of the latest from Polly Jean Harvey. We're both enthused about it. How do you feel about it? Our listeners, we want to hear from you. Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your review so we can share it on the show. Coming up, we're going to talk about the secret Midwestern roots of country music. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. Today, we're airing a conversation with one of our old newspaper colleagues on the Chicago music beat, Mark Guarino, about his fantastic new book, Country and Midwestern.
That is right, Jim. We recorded this interview in front of a live audience at the Park West as part of the Chicago Humanities Festival. You know, in 2007, the University of Chicago came out with a study describing Chicago as a music city in hiding. I would say just about everybody, most people would casually know that Chicago's, you know, urban blues is a mainstay of Chicago, might know that gospel music started here, essentially, two gigantic genres of music. But almost everyone I've ever talked to, when I brought up country music, they go, "What? Chicago? Country music? No, never happened." So thank you for writing this book, because that addresses that head on. So I'm wondering, Mark, did you get into the, was that, yeah, absolutely, a very much needed book, but was that in your subconscious when you started researching this 10 years ago?
Yeah, and actually it goes back, I thought about that even 10 years before that. It was really to correct an injustice I felt that was out there. I'd seen how Chicago did a really poor job even in promoting its blues history and the gospel and all the genres you mentioned.
House.
Yeah, house. And to a point, I was watching Muddy Waters' house about to be demolished. I was very upset about that, and the music I was really interested in, and I wrote a lot about, was the music that's in the book. And I was really, I was asking myself, like, why does no one know about any of this stuff, and not just even in Chicago, but outside Chicago, which I think is almost even more important, because as time goes on, narrative starts setting into concrete, and the history is sort of set by the people who really decide that's what it is. And I thought, well, you know, there's an opportunity here to kind of connect the threads, not just of the time I was living in, but really kind of going back to the early part of the century and showing how, like, somebody like Robbie, who's going to be on next, is really connected to artists going back more than a century ago.
You begin to get old and feeble, and the world's turned you down, and you have to take two walking sticks just to hobble into town. You can hear your kinfolks talking, they'll be whispering all around. Poor old grandpa be better off when he's 6 feet underground. We live a long, long time to get old. We live a long, long time to get old. So there ain't no need to cry. Poor old grandpa's gotta die. We live a long, long time to get old.
So, you know, Nashville, the studios, the labels, Grand Ole Opry, blah, 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 home of country music. A little radio show from Chicago that had the advantage of being on WLS and reaching, what, a third of the country? Mm-hmm. did more than any other media to popularize this music. Tell us about the barn dance.
Well, you know, it was really 1924, and radio had only been around for about a year or two, if you can believe that. And in Chicago, there was this mad rush to produce radios. You had high school kids at Lane Tech cranking out radios to bring them home because there weren't enough to buy. And so kind of like the streaming issue now with all these million shows on Roku, there needed to be content on these shows. And so up to the point, they didn't know what to put. So they put opera, and they put somebody reading children's stories, you know, to kids at nighttime. They didn't really, or reciting poetry. And so one Saturday night, the first month WLS won of the year in 1924, the program manager said, hey, let's get some of these couple fiddlers to come in and play. And they did. And it was the most popular thing that they had for the month, but still popular. And it really, they thought it grew from there.
Everywhere, how's Mother and Dad and the whole family? Well, folks, that old harvest moon is shining down extra bright on the old red barn tonight, and for a very special reason. Yes, the Alka-Seltzer National Barn Dance Gang is celebrating its ninth birthday, its 470th happy hayloft party from the old WLS hayloft in Chicago.
And it became the show that really established the blueprint of how do you market mass music to audiences across the country. That hadn't been done before to that extent, where there's merchandise, where there's a magazine, where there are road shows, where there are Hollywood movies. All this sort of stuff was established here in Chicago through WLS's massive, at the time, marketing machine. And also, it was a show that brought all these Southerners up and gave them new names, gave them backstories, and really used their talents to show, to kind of reinvent this sort of idea of the rural singer or fiddler or vocal group to a wider audience. And they were broadcasting that to rural America, not just to Southern America, but you know, to across the Midwest. And because the music was a rural music at that time, it wasn't a Southern thing, and it became a Southern thing decades later. And so, yeah, that was really kind of the significance of the barn dance.
That having been said, having listened to some of those really, boy, was it hokey.
Yeah, that's right. For modern ears, it is kind of hokey. Yeah, for sure.
Say, Pat Buttram.
Yeah, Jody, yeah.
Say, Pat, there's a fellow around here a while ago looking for you. He said you knew him.
Oh, he said I knowed him?
Uh-huh.
What was his name?
Well, I don't remember his name. I'd know it, though, if I heard it.
Let me see. I know him, huh?
Yeah,
Was his name Brewer?
No.
Was it Campbell?
No.
Was it Brown?
Nope.
Was it Brown?
I told you once his name wasn't Brown.
Well, I know two Browns. I thought maybe it's the other.
But the songs were the songs that had been around for hundreds of years. And so a lot of those, the people in the barn dance went back to Appalachia to go find, we need more songs. Where, you know, do you know any songs? And collecting those songs, putting them into songbooks, and kind of like making them much more entertaining and soothing for, at the time, modern ears. The songs carried through, and a lot of the songs are sung today, obviously. So it was sort of this, like, it was a carrier for the songs until country music really modernized with the honky-tonk era in the 50s, late 40s, 50s. So it became relevant until about World War II, when Nashville really became the place where the music was going to go to the next level. It wasn't going to happen at WLS because it was run by an agriculture magazine that were like, we like it like this.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because it was the voice of country music for decades, right, early on. And people had this idea of what this rural life was like, and it was very happy and very wholesome. And then it died when, as you mentioned, the honky-tonk version of country started to
you know, new generation of artists came in, and the Grand Ole Opry sort of grabbed that, and that it became the center of country music. But the thing that your book did, Mark, that really opened my eyes, and you drew that connection to what happened in that country scene in Chicago in the 20s and 30s and 40s to the folk scene in Chicago that sort of grew out of that. And it was a natural extension of it, and I'd never thought of it that way, really. But to me, Win Strachey was like the key figure because he was singing on the barn dance at one point, wasn't he? And here he is on the ground floor of the folk scene in Chicago.
When he was in his 20s, he was in a group called the Melody Men. Talk about hokey. And on the barn dance, you're right. And so, and a lot of the barn dance performers were rediscovered by the folk people, by the folk revival in the 50s. Because they were still around, but no one cared about them whatsoever. No one paid any attention to them, but they were rediscovered during that era, too. But Win Strachey, he's sort of the unsung hero of this book. He starts the book, I have a quote from him, that he really described Chicago really well as this place that is sort of an incubator for the creative impulse and the experimental the impulse to experiment. But then he appears almost every chapter because he lived a long life, and he lived this life like out of a Mark Twain novel where he had a million different lives. And the Old Town School folk music was his last chapter. And it was really, I think that it was his greatest contribution, not to Chicago, but to the country.
Away up in the North Woods, right on the borderline, a great commercial city, Chicago, you will find. Her men are all like Abilene, her women like Eloise. All honest, virtuous people, for they live in Illinois. So move your family westward, bring all your girls and boys, and cross that Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois. And cross that Shawnee Ferry to the state of Illinois.
Well, and the Old Town School of Folk Music gets itself an FBI file. God bless the Freedom of Information Act. Took you a year, but the feds had those reds, those dangerous reds, up at the Old Town School under observation.
That's right. When I was writing the book, you know, I was learning about Win Strachey's connection to the labor movement, and his best friend was Studs Terkel, who we all know. He was a red, and I always Studs Terkel famously talked about his FBI file. It was on the internet. He was proud of it, and I thought, well, if he has one, then his circle must have one. And so I sent out requests for all of their FBI files of all these people who started the Old Town School. And about a year later, they started coming in. And what I discovered was that every person involved with the Old Town School was under heavy, heavy surveillance by the U.S. government. And with Win Strachey in particular, and also these, somebody asked me, was it a great actor? Absolutely not. They read like novels. The agent would go back and he would write up what his interview was. And essentially what they did was they went to different parts of his life to interview his employer. He worked for NBC in Chicago. He was a singer for Fourth Presbyterian Church on Michigan Avenue. And basically they would go and ask, do you realize that he's a communist? And you know what happened after that? All of his jobs went away. He got fired.
Right. That's not funny.
And then they would go to family members. And so this thing lasted for years. He grew very depressed. He was unemployed. And by the time that the Old Town School came around, he was trying to market himself as a classical singer for weddings and special events and that kind of thing.
Is there any indication that they're still monitoring wiggle worms?
That's right. It's very dangerous, and
beatniks, bebop, and
get them young.
Yeah.
Get them young, and
all these radicals. I love the idea, though, that folk was perceived as this, you know, enemy of the state, you know, and I think because of the content of the music, but also who it represented. it represented the underclass, the disadvantaged, the people whose voices weren't being heard by mainstream society.
And also, like, there was a racial component to it. One of the founders of the Old Town School was a homemaker in New York named Dawn Greening. And their house became sort of, I think of her as like a music super fan today, the people I see at shows all the time who would have living room shows or backyard shows. She was that person in the 50s. And she opened her house to all these musicians. And so all these musicians would come through, Odetta, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Peggy Seeger. They stayed in her home in Oak Park on Lombard Avenue. And a lot of the performers were black. And the neighbors complained, and the FBI agent showed up and were asking why were so many black people coming over, seen coming in and out of your house? What are you doing here? And they would always deny that they were communists, and they would, the FBI would leave them with some literature, but they would come back months later and do the same thing. So they were harassed for years simply for having musicians stay at their home.
Well, you know, we know about Maxwell Street. The birth of urban blues. And of course, we paved it over and tore it down. We did not know, or I didn't know, Madison Street was honky-tonk central. As you say in the book, sex workers, fights every 5 minutes, alcoholic bars, and great, great music. And then Daly paves it through for the highway and destroys that musical center.
Absolutely. So the next time you go to a Bulls game, think about what was there beforehand and what was there stretching from the West Loop, what we call now, all the way to really where the United Center is, was a vice district that were basically, it was a stopping point for people coming up from the South, for laborers seeking work. But almost every block, and I saw a few photos of it, you know, just as evidence too, every block had rows and rows of these more or less storefront honky-tonks. And once you start looking into what happened there, the police blotters over the years, it was, you know, it's out of a Coen Brothers movie, frankly.
I was thinking of The Hideout.
Yeah, The Hideout, right, exactly.
They're trying to pave that under,
that's
too.
That's right. Well, one theme really, again, writing this book over so many years, some things just kind of like emerged out of it. I was watching get brighter and brighter, and one of them was, really, the city of Chicago, anytime in every single era when something was becoming successful, a business owner with a music club and a scene starting to form, the city came in and did everything it could to shut it down. It happened what we're talking about. It happened with the Quiet Night in Lakeview. It happened with the College of Complexes, which was a crazy folk scene, that folk club that had to keep moving to get away from the city. It happened with Lounge Acts in Lincoln Park. It was probably the last one in the book that talks about that. And of course, what we're talking about with Hideout, one thing's the city becomes more the more affluent the city becomes, the more control it wants to have, it starts clamping down on these business owners. And so what we're seeing now with the Hideout, or what we saw with Lounge Acts, that story's been going on for decades.
Yeah. The Madison Street thing is just phenomenal to me. I did a piece on it a while ago, but there was this guitar player, Johnny Pitts, he told me the story. There was like drive-by shootings there, yeah. Right? And it's basically like rural Southerners who came up to the big city.
It's all the Great Migration.
But the music had this drive and rawness and energy to it. And Pitts was telling me, he was playing the guitar, and one night somebody just fired a bunch of rounds into the club and broke the neck off of his guitar while he was playing on stage. And people say the South Side now is rough, right. You know?
I mean, it's No, it was really, it was violent, and also the same, you know, I had a great quote there from Charlie Musselwhite, the blues harmonica player, who is fantastic. I saw him a couple of weeks ago perform in New Orleans. I interviewed him because he was a Memphis teenager. He came up to Chicago seeking work, like everybody else he knew, and he would go to the South Side blues clubs, but he lived in Uptown. He worked for an exterminator in Uptown, and that was his day job. So I called him up and I wanted to talk to him, like, what were you seeing in all these clubs? And he said, you know, the people said the South Side blues clubs were really violent. There's a handgun in the drawer of the register and all that other stuff. He said they had nothing on the country bars on the north side because he said the fights on the south side usually were about something. They're about, you know, you looked at my woman wrong, you owe me money, you stole something from me. The fights on the north side were like, you looked at me wrong. And he said because life had these people over so much that that they had nothing left and they were just going to go at it. John Prine, who I interviewed, his dad would take him. I shouldn't say this. His dad would take him to some of these bars before Cubs games. He told me a story. His dad of a wisdom he gave his dad of like, hey son, when you're in a bar like this, you always order beers by double. You drink one, and you have one at the ready to knock somebody over the head with when they want to pick a fight with you. And he was serious. He was serious. Yeah.
But I had no idea what a good time would cause till last night when I sat and talked with you. An apple will spoil if it's been abused. A candle disappears when it's been used.
Well, and then there was the tale about, I loved the Al Grossman anecdotes. Al Grossman, future manager of Bob Dylan, Janis Joplin, all these iconic figures. Grossman sort of started the modern manager scenario, right? But the Gate of Horn. And he sort of legitimizes the whole folk scene, right? He tries to dress it up a little bit.
Yeah, folk singers were considered hillbillies, more or less. You know, I mean, they were in denim and they were just street clothing. He put them in suits. And he made it a respect. He put cocktail tables out, and it became a place for middle-class suburbanites to go after work to go hear these songs. And Bob Gibson was a really entertaining folk singer who was really one of the house performers there, had a very clean-cut image of presenting songs that were from, like, decades earlier. So, yeah, he cleaned everything up there. And you could see how that method, you know, he formed Peter, Paul, and Mary. He basically put them together and he sold them to America. He sold all the music that was in the Gate of Horn through Peter, Paul, and Mary. And, you know, he wanted to do another trio called the Brown Eyed Girls. And there were three women performers, I think Joe Mapes and two other women. But one of them said to him, "But I don't have brown eyes." And he said, "Well, fix that."
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mark Guarino about how Chicago became the epicenter of the old country boom in the 1990s. Then we'll pay tribute to Tony Bennett. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
I love my country.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. We're talking with author Mark Guarino in front of an audience at the Chicago Humanities Festival about his book, Country and Midwestern. Let's get the more recent history of country music in Chicago.
Well, Mark, you covered the alt-country explosion, right? And it's interesting, giving it context as you do in the book. It's also great migration. We have people coming from Wales. We have people coming from St. Louis. You know, everybody comes in. Why did bands like Wilco and, you know, the extended Langford Meekins family, the Handsome family, you know, how did all these new resurgent country bands wind up in Chicago? Why'd they come here, and what did it do for them?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. One was a reason why other artists came here during that time period. It was very affordable to live here, and there were a lot of record labels here. It had already established a reputation for, you know, rock and punk and all sorts of indie music and jazz, and so it seemed like a really fertile place for musicians to just come here. The musicians that you talk about, I think that what they discovered, what they got when they went here was freedom. Frankly, when I talked to the Handsome family, they weren't really planning to do anything super great when they got here. But when they got here, Chicago looked like it was a pretty dark and grimy place at that time. It was a place where you can kind of get inspired to write, and also you had the freedom to do really whatever you wanted. And I think that sort of thing caught on like wildfire, because there were places to play, there was an audience that was interested in it, and there was this collaborative vibe that you see in other music scenes as well. I mean, Robbie, who will be here tonight, he collaborated with Steve Albini, who is as uncountry as possible, you know, as you might think, but they became natural collaborators on his records. And so I think that that sort of thing kind of caught on, that you can live here for pretty cheap, but also you have this like really amazing group of musicians here that you can start collaborating. So all of a sudden you start seeing it. All the people you mentioned just start working with one another. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and even, you know, we're sort of drawing the link to the what happened in the 90s, a very exciting period for Chicago with all these groups experimenting within the framework of country music. Langford, you know, the man from Wales that Jim mentioned, the Meekins guy, you know, just a terrific musician, artist. You know, I said, what's this country music thing? He says, well, we tried to imitate it, but we got it so wrong that we created our own thing out of it. And that was kind of like what it was, you know? It was like, okay, your mistakes became your sound. And
yeah,
that was cool.
And I don't think it would have been able to, I mean, I think there were little scenes in other cities, but I don't think it would have been able to really flourish as it did because of the size of Chicago and the number of musicians here. And I think that that sort of, kind of the middle finger to other cities that thought they were cooler than Chicago. It's like, no, we're going to do something very original here. We're going to do our own thing. And you saw how that really grew and grew, and you saw these artists then who basically are, you know, in my estimation, sort of the premier Americana artists today, had roots in Chicago at some period of time during that time period.
Well, Mark, you know the Sound Opinions aesthetic. Everybody's a critic, and this is a positive book, lauding Chicago. But talk a little bit about, from all of the eras, the country music out of Chicago versus the crap that comes from mainstream Nashville.
I mean, there's critics here who can say that what you're hearing in the super mainstream, it's gone as far beyond as you can even imagine of what country music is, and far beyond its even roots. Even going back to the 90s, Garth Brooks seems like a traditionalist today, frankly.
Compared
he really
to,
does.
Yeah. No, it's pop music.
Yeah,
now.
Absolutely. And it's funny because at that time he was kind of, oh, you know, boy, what's where's things going? He's as much of a traditionalist than I think compared to really what's out there. I think that it's such a segmented music now, like all pop music, that you can't. The labels are sort of meaningless now. Like what is country music now? And I think that. And it took having to go through that period of whatever you wanted to call it, alt country, and kind of keep circling back to the roots of the music to really be where we're at today. That because the pop stuff has gone as far in that direction as it could go. And so if you like that stuff, great. But now there's, you know, what we're seeing now is that Americana, the Americana Music Awards, there's a Grammy category now for Americana music. That music is incredibly mainstream now. So you can find that music now, whereas before it was indie labels and indie clubs. And now those artists are playing places like the Chicago Theater and are heard on radio.
The whole notion of Chicago being this sort of hidden enclave of country music. Jim, you wanted to ask about Robbie's exploits at the R&R Lounge downtown?
I wanted you to tell the story of the Sundowners, and the Sun-Times excerpted it, and it's great in the book. It's great in the paper.
Sure, yeah. So the Sundowners is this, like, I'm waiting for someone to make a film about them because it's sort of this group that existed for three decades in a subterranean bar talk about an improbable story, you know, improbable scenario. This band playing, you know, seven sets a night or whatever it is, five, six nights a week. And for three decades in the same place. And it did move, but And so what they were three Southern, they just thought, like, you know, they were working class musicians. And so they did something I think that was brilliant. They just stayed put. And they stayed put and the audience came to them. And they had an audience of tourists, politicians, media types. And then eventually as the 80s roll around, sort of people like John Langford were walking down the stairs. And I know Robbie saw them. And anyone who was of that in their 20s in the 80s was showing up there. And they opened the doors to all those people and let them come on stage, let them play guitar with them, let them sing with them, kind of showed them what it's like, what the lifestyle's really like. You had to be really good.
Now I'm walking on the sidewalks of Chicago. If I buy the bread, I can't afford the wine. Now I'm walking on sidewalks of Chicago, wishing I had lived some other time.
And they were incredible players, and they knew 15,000 songs. That's not an exaggeration. 15,000 songs.
They were amazing. And in the 80s, they were sort of holding down the fort for that sound, right in the loop, like near the Greyhound bus station or something like that, right? And but the link there to what was the folk scene was about, you know, the University of Chicago Festival was very about the community and everybody can play. Nobody's voice is, you know, everybody can sing. You know, the whole idea that you all have something in here that needs to be expressed, and that's okay. And what I loved about them, the Sundowners, they were so generous, as you alluded to. If you showed up with an instrument, you're probably going to be getting up on stage with them at some point in the evening. And the beauty of it was they'd give you the stage, but Don, the guitar player, would sort of hang with you just to make sure, hey, we're going to stay in key, we're going to be on the song here, we're going to do Lost Highway by Hank Williams, and we're going to get through this together. And that, I love that. I thought that was just so
spirit
of what this whole Chicago thing was all about.
A lot of the musicians would say to them, or, you know, would tell me that they on the stage would tell them, like, All right, now go like they would be giving him like waste. It's this while they were playing, you know. It's like this, you know. And it's amazing that these guys and those guys, the younger musicians, they revere them today. They love them, you know. I didn't hear anyone say any bad word about any of those guys. I think because they were so welcoming. And then what's amazing is that the Sundowners start playing places like the Club Lower Links, where there are punk rockers in another subterranean bar under Links Hall.
Well, and
in Lakeview.
Postmodern video art and performance
that's
art.
That's right. So all these Art
Slam.
Institute students are doing crazy performance art in the 70s. And then you have these three country guys with the hats, and they're playing full sets at Club Lower Links. And that moment in time was really the start. That was the start of this kind of melding of these kind of punk rockers, art kids with the country music stuff. And there was respect all around. It wasn't sort of like a thing, well, we're kind of making fun of this, it's ironic. Because a lot of that stuff came later, where people would just wear Western shirts and kind of wink at the music. No, this was, we love this. And we love the fact that there's a there's something happening here over generations. It's a beautiful thing. And I think that sort of exchange between generations happens a lot in the book and among these musicians. That's why I wanted to dedicate the book to musicians, because I felt the generosity of spirit. It's amazing.
Well, you and I talked a little bit about this a few days ago, but I thought there was a really great point that you made, that you know, you became the music critic at the Herald, Daily Herald in 97. And you were sort of right in the middle of this whole era where this alt-country thing was becoming growing out of a Chicago thing into this national thing, and really became quite amazing, you know, because there were so many great bands. So who's the unsung band from that huge pool of talent that we had here in your mind?
You know, I could talk about a band that's still around that is, Steve Dawson, the songwriter Steve Dawson. And I think this guy, as a songwriter, he could go to Nashville and just, like, clean their clocks with all his songs and his singing and the records that his band Dolly Varden has put out. I think also Danny Black. The Blacks.
I was wondering if you're going to bring up the Blacks.
The Blacks were great.
The Blacks were around for just like a minute. They put out two records, one EP, but you will find no more charismatic group of musicians and primal musicians on stage than those crazy foursome. And Danny, when he performs solo, it's amazing. You know, he's such a charismatic guy, but his songs are really, he has a real understanding of the older country music as well. People kind of would see just kind of some of the antics on stage. They would wear wigs. He would wear a preacher's outfit. And that stuff went away over time. But I think that it was easy to kind of focus on that stuff. I think glam country was a term that was kind of came out of that. But as a songwriter, his stuff is very, very deep. And I wish, I'm kind of on a mission, as we all are, when we hook onto people we love, just to, like, we want the spotlight on them, you know, more. And so I want him to come back and play more shows. Yeah.
Place to end.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you.
That wraps up our chat with Mark Guarino, and now we want to hear from you. Were you aware of the Midwestern roots of country music? Do you agree with Mark's assessment? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, with your thoughts.
I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill, it calls to me.
That is the iconic song, I Left My Heart in San Francisco. 1962 live performance at Carnegie Hall that put Tony Bennett on the map as one of the great singers.
He'd never been there. I love that fact.
Well, they, you know, and it's interesting because San Francisco sort of adopted him, but he's a New Yorker through and through, right?
Long Island City, Queens.
Absolutely. Grew up there. And, you know, one of the great vocalists, without a doubt, of the last half century plus, really, and a gentleman and a scholar. I mean, a true Renaissance man in terms of his interests, you know, all over the map. In fact, became a very celebrated painter as his career evolved, in addition to the singing. The thing that I love about Tony, and people are wondering, why are you talking about Tony Bennett? He's not rock and roll. Well, you know, he was adopted by the rock and roll community later on. Lady Gaga, of course, famously singing with him. He was on the Grammy Awards as a regular, which is amazing when you think a guy who was 60 plus reinventing his career in that way. The thing about Bennett is he rarely performed songs that he wasn't totally invested in. He wasn't into the gimmicks. He wasn't into, you know, oh, now's your time to sing rock and roll. He tried a Beatles song in the 60s because some producer insisted on it. It wasn't very good.
Didn't work.
I'm never doing that again. I'm doing what's in my heart. And he sort of followed that influence. Didn't have Sinatra's swagger. Didn't have Crosby's perfect tone, you know, that deep tone. But he did have this sort of everyman quality to it. You know, he identified with every word he sang. There was a nuance in that singer. He, you know, people said, well, he was a jazz singer. No, he was a singer influenced by jazz. I wouldn't call him a jazz singer. But there was an integrity to that voice and an investment in what he was singing that I think a lot of people thought was just so warm and so inviting that made him a celebrated superstar across the decades.
Well, you mentioned Frank Sinatra, my native Hoboken. For my money, Tony Bennett is the best singer in the business, Frank said.
Yeah, well, who's going to argue with Sinatra?
You don't argue with Frank, no.
But you talked to him, I did too, and I just want to say one other thing about him. I just thought, you know, the hype, as advertised, he was supposed to be this soulful guy, and he was. You know, he was indeed one of those people who made everybody around him feel welcome.
No, absolutely. We can't slight his political contributions, Greg. Sang for Nelson Mandela, sang for John F. Kennedy and Bill Clinton. Marched in Selma.
Right.
The Selma to Montgomery Civil Rights March, along with Harry Belafonte and Sammy Davis Jr., was there when Dr. Martin Luther King gave the famous address, the How Long, Not Long speech. Was driven to the airport by a volunteer from Michigan who was killed right after she dropped him off by the KKK.
Right.
I mean, Tony was on the front lines. That's one thing I think that needs to be noted, because a lot of obits are missing that. Another thing is that 2000s Renaissance began in the 2000s. Full albums with Diana Krall, Katie Lang, Lady Gaga, and then three duets albums where Tony is paired with everyone from Dixie Chicks to Sting, Bono to John Legend, Queen Latifah to Mariah Carey. I was a bit cynical about those, all right? I talked to Tony during those collaborations twice because I had an editor who was a super fan. I think that was his son pushing him to do that.
Uh-huh.
And he was a nice man, and he would have sung with anyone, especially these standards he loved, and he loved seeing younger musicians realize that, you know, it's not that far from Etta James to Queen Latifah. Mm-hmm. Let's sing some of these standards, right? But I think there was a bit of a cynicism there, because both times I talked to him, he said, you know what, kind of rather be painting, but happy to talk to you, Jim. He really would have rather been painting in later life. And I got a Christmas card from him for 10 years every Christmas. You know, a nice man. He especially was close to Amy Winehouse. He was really moved by her voice. So I think to pay tribute to Tony Bennett, dead at the age of 96, let's listen to one of those duets that worked Not all of them did. This is Body and Soul by Tony Bennett and Amy Winehouse from 2012.
My life a wreck you're making.
You know I'm yours, but just the taking.
I can't return, you know, myself to you, body and soul.
Body and Soul, Tony Bennett and a woman he greatly admired, Amy Winehouse. Greg, what do we got on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to talk to Kim Mack. Did a wonderful book about Living Color, a band that we haven't dived into extensively on the show in the past,
no.
I'm afraid to say, but we're going to redress that balance next week.
We're, you know, I don't think we're ever going to run out of things that we have overlooked and are excited about talking about. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Kai.
Oh, I'm the culture person now.